This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Graphic novel sales were up nearly 12% last year. That's compared to a 1% bump for all book sales. The healthy growth is likely no surprise to many of you who left messages in our inbox gushing about your love for the cartoon panel style of storytelling.
My name is Becca, calling from Denver, Colorado. I recently became very, very intrigued by graphic novels and have read probably about 24 in the last month. I was never into graphic novels growing up. I was always into hardcore and big books that you could really dive into. It wasn't until I met my husband around about 8 years ago, who is a huge comic book fan, that I truly got into comic books and then furthermore got into graphic novels. I would definitely say it's one of the greatest things I ever found in my life. I've read some amazing pieces of work.
Many readers like Becca are introduced to graphic novels through superhero comic books, but the medium is bigger than that. Today we'll speak to two graphic novelists with new books that are out this month. Later, we'll hear an Old West story that veers far from the stereotypical cowboy tale. The main characters are a queer Latinx outlaw and a trans runaway. We begin with a graphic novel set in one day in 1975 in a snow-blanketed town in Nebraska. The title character, Rusty Brown, is the tiny piece of human grit about which they involuntarily orbit, the characters. That's how the cartoonist, Chris Ware, describes it. His latest work follows the success of his graphic novel Jimmy Corrigan, Smartest Kid on Earth, back in 2000, of which Dave Eggers wrote in the New York Times, quote, "In terms of sheer aesthetic virtuosity, Ware's book is arguably the greatest achievement of the form ever," unquote. Chris Ware joins us from Chicago. His latest graphic novel is called Rusty Brown. He's also illustrated more than 20 covers of The New Yorker. Chris, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted and terrified to be here.
Why terrified?
I'm used to sitting alone at a table and staring out the window, and you're actually part of my work avoidance regimen, actually. I have the radio on all day long and listen to your show regularly.
So it's kind of it's mixed.
I'm thrilled, though. Yes.
Okay. Good. I promise we will make this as painless as possible. Chris, tell us about Rusty Brown and the story. What's it about?
Oh boy, I was hoping you were going to ask me that. Well, you already said.
So you're already terrified, and I've asked you the question that you're hoping. I am not off to a good start, man. This is not going well for me.
There's a reason we cartoonists do what we do, which is so we don't have to do this and talk about ourselves. But as you said, it starts out in a day in 1975, starting with kids arriving at school, and breaks off around lunchtime, and then kind of splits apart into three different stories about three of the characters involved in the previous part of the book. So it's the first half of a book I've been working on for a long time. I should, in my own pathetic defense, say that I've been working on other books as well. I did another graphic novel called Building Stories about 2012 or so. So, but comics is an incredibly labor-intense and very dense and uneconomical medium, and so it takes a while. I mean, my aim is to try to make a book that's as dense and as rich as I think real life is, but it takes some tinkering. So,
well, let's back up and talk about the art form for a second, and then I'll come back to Rusty Brown. We heard from a number of our listeners who really love graphic novels. I love graphic novels myself. Here's what Shelley left in our inbox.
My name is Shelley. I'm part of a book club in Tooele, Utah, and one of our members chose the graphic novel My Friend Dahmer, and we all really enjoyed it. I never thought a graphic novel would be anything other than a comic book. Now I'm looking into the graphic novel prequels for the Stephen King Dark Tower series, and I'm completely enjoying it.
Shelley, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. Chris, I think a good just foundational place to start would be how you conceive of a graphic novel. Shelley said she never thought of it as anything other than a comic book. Is a graphic novel just a comic book with more pages, or is there more to it than that?
Well, I mean, I think that's kind of how it started, or how a lot of we cartoonists started, and certainly in my generation, we grew up reading that stuff. But as far as I'm concerned, I think comics as a medium and as a visual medium, I mean, Nabokov said that memory is an accumulation of images. If you can conceive of the comic book medium as a combination of not only words and images, but images that are meant to be read. It deploys a kind of strange ability that we humans have to read images as well as see them. So you have this illusion on the page of something actually happening before your eyes when it's actually happening in your mind and memory at the same time. And as well, I think it's probably the one visual medium where you can kind of create a sense of the multi-layered experience of consciousness. Whereas if, like, even at this moment where I'm staring at this carpeted wall of this recording studio, I can visualize other things at the same time without seeing them, as well as remember various parts of my life when I was otherwise similarly uncomfortable. So there's a lot going on in the human brain that I think comics can at least try to get a little bit of a attempt at getting down on the page.
What were some of your early influences? Were you a fan of comic books growing up, or did you kind of come to this genre a little bit later?
I was more than a fan of comic books as a kid, certainly superhero comics. I believed them as almost sort of a gospel truth. I really thought I was going to grow up and get superpowers, and then when I grew up in adolescence, and exactly the opposite thing happened. In fact, things just kind of fell apart at that point. I realized that this was not I've been kind of fed this lie or something. Of course, now that superheroes are at the forefront of American culture, which is interesting. But more than that, I read Peanuts, I think, with a kind of it was such a warmth to Charles Schulz's work, and he was really the first cartoonist to create a sense of somebody on the page that you not only you care for, but almost through. I really think Schulz's accomplishment in the art form is to create the first empathetic cartoon character in Charlie Brown. And without that, the rest of us cartoonists really would still be operating at kind of a base level, I think. So,
you said that you prefer being called a cartoonist rather than a graphic novelist. Why is that?
That might be an old quote. It's the graphic novelist sounds both kind of maybe like you're trying to be a little pretentious and fancy, which I really kind of cherish the place that comics have in culture as a trash medium, because nobody's going to come to a cartoonist and assume that they're like a painter or a writer, you know, that they know more, that they're, when you read a comic strip, you just assume if you don't like it that the cartoonist is an idiot, and I really cherish that. So, but I at the same time, if after trying to explain what it is that I do to regular socialized human beings, it's easier to just say I'm a graphic novelist, and that seems to kind of now stand in for a cartoonist who writes long books.
Does that change over time, though? I mean, now that, you know, the Marvel Cinematic Universe has been such a roaring success, you know, Avengers Endgame is now the highest grossing movie of all time. And, you know, people are seeing more of these crossovers between printed comic books and movies and TV shows and theme park attractions. I wonder, from your perspective as an artist, whether it's easier to talk to people about what this art form is, because they go, oh, yeah, that thing that started as a comic strip, the comic book. Yeah, I can kind of relate to that.
Well, I think the problem here is that there's kind of a conflation between form and content. Comics as a they're not a genre. They're a language and a medium through which stories can be told. And at least in America, the superhero genre was the content of them for many decades, simply because it was a way of bilking kids out of their milk money. Really, it was like the cheapest way of producing stories and kind of a junk content and making money off of them. And now that that's moved to cinema, there's nothing about superheroes or that sort of overinflated masculinity that has anything to do with the medium of comics itself. It's just an American sort of association. In Europe, the most popular comics are Westerns. You know, go figure. I don't even know what that's about exactly, but...
And we'll be speaking to a graphic novel artist who wrote a Western that caught our attention. We'll speak to her in a moment. But for now, we continue our conversation with Chris Ware, whose new work is called Rusty Brown, also the author of Jimmy Corrigan, The Smartest Kid on Earth. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Google. From Connecticut to California, from Mississippi to Minnesota, millions of American businesses are using Google tools to grow online. The Grow with Google initiative supports small businesses by providing free digital skills workshops and one-on-one coaching in all 50 states, helping businesses get online, connect with new customers, and work more productively. Learn more at google.com/grow.
An incident in Nashville that shocked the Latino community. A computer designed to control the entire Chilean economy. A Martian invasion in Ecuador. Radio Ambulante is back with a brand new season. NPR's Spanish language podcast will take you around Latin America to show you the fascinating, strange, and compelling stories of the region. Subscribe and listen every Tuesday.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to hear from some of you who have been getting into this art form. Jenny is in Murray, Kentucky, and Jenny emailed, "My 8-year-old daughter just got me into graphic novels. Back in the early 90s, I read the series The Babysitter's Club. Now there's an author who has reimagined these wonderful Anne M. Martin books. My 8-year-old loves them, and I do too." Rusty Brown is a very different kind of graphic novel than anything I've read. And I've not read every single one, but I've read Watchmen. I've read some of the graphic novels that are basically just kind of comic book anthologies. Mm-hmm. This book, as I understand it, was about 18 years in the making. It is massive. It is about 70% the thickness of a phone book. Like, I'm gonna let this book fall on the desk in front of me. Listen. That book's got some heft. Like, you could
very dramatic.
You could do something to somebody with this book. How does a story like this, that is this big, that is this expansive, come to be? I mean, did you know that Rusty Brown was going to be this much book?
Well, I knew that it would take me a while and that it would be kind of long, but I tend to work very improvisatorially and organically. I guess those are fancy words to basically say I make it up as I go along, because I found that in the past, if I scripted something, it would arrive kind of dead on arrival and just not feel real. And I realized that's because I wasn't listening or paying attention to the pictures on the page as I was working. So the result of this then is then that things can kind of spiral out of control. But really, that's kind of what life is all about, is about spiraling out of control. You have an idea of who you are and where your life is going to go, but it almost never goes in that direction. You're always readjusting what you think your aims are. So, and I wanted to do a book that had some of the heft and weight of real life, and really it doesn't necessarily, it's not clear what it's about, because I really feel like the books that I've been most moved by are fall into that category, like Anna Karenina or Ulysses, and you can't really say what they're about necessarily, but they have a sort of complexity and a richness and a tangledness that you can't really grasp, that seems to point at life itself.
And this is just the first half of the story, is that right?
I've done other books at the same time. I work on them piecemeal. As I get tired of working on one, I'll shift over to another, and I'm working on two others right at the moment. But that's part of it too, because we all remember our lives over our entire lives. And as we go on, those memories change and shift and readjust until in some cases they almost turn into lies. So this is kind of an attempt to get at that way that we rewrite our own stories of ourselves and how they shift. And in comics, it's a medium. As you work on things, you tend to draw differently as time goes on. If you look at Peanuts when it first began, Charlie Brown looks completely different than the way he does when Charles Schulz was older. So,
how much of this book, if any, is autobiographical? One of the characters is named Mr. Ware. It's set in your hometown of Omaha. It also deals with a lot of really very intense themes in the book. It feels like a very, you know, adult story in a medium that can be associated with kind of kids' literature, but how much of this book is a reflection of you as opposed to a reflection of themes you wanted to explore?
Well, even if it's themes I want to explore, it's still 100% me, whether I make, fiction is really just operating on yourself. It's experimenting with trying to bring people back to life that maybe you miss, or imagining what if one's life had taken a different path, or what would it be like to be another person, which is really, I think, the most important thing that we as humans can do, is to try to imagine other people and to try to feel through other people, because otherwise what's the point of being alive, you know? And I think fiction provides not necessarily a guide to doing that, but sort of a rudder that you can put in the water of life to kind of help steer you maybe a little bit in that regard.
Skip tweeted, I have to take umbrage at your graphic novel artist's comment that Charlie Brown was the first relatable character who made all later such characters possible. Obviously, he's too young to remember Walt Kelly's seminal character, Pogo. Point taken, Skip. And Chris, I think that just kind of underscores how seriously some people take this art form.
Yeah, well, I didn't say relatable. I said empathetic. And I think of Charlie Brown as a character you feel for and through. You can really... Charles Schulz did something with his handwriting on the page where you embody these characters. There's almost like a weird sensation when you read his work. I sent Charlie Brown a Valentine when I was a little kid because I felt so sorry for him. And, I mean, I think Pogo is great,
Up. Don't breeze past that. You sent Charlie Brown a Valentine?
I did. Yeah, I felt so sorry for Charlie Brown that he didn't have any friends and that he wanted a Valentine that I wrote him one and mailed it to him. And my mom worked at the Omaha World Herald as a reporter, so she, you know, sort of played along and said, oh, yeah, I'll send this to him at the newspaper. And I, even at the time, I kind of knew, I'm like, this is not really a real person, but it still felt so much like a real person and that it sort of broke my heart so much that he just didn't have any friends that I wanted to try to do something to kind of ameliorate that feeling of anguish and loneliness that he embodied as a cartoon character on the page. It's really astonishing when you think what Schulz was able to do in just those little sort of tiny doodles that he published every day.
And what would you like for your work to be able to do for people? Granted, you've published a variety of different kinds of work, but let's just say Rusty Brown. Is there anything in particular you'd like for folks to be able to explore through it or to take away from it before we let you go?
Well, I mean, I'm trying to create as much of a sense of the richness and complexity and confusability of life itself, and really to create a sense of what it's like to be another person and to feel through other people, and really just, you know, to try to inculcate that idea that just trying to be nice to other people, which really seems to have been kind of lost over the past 3 years or so. It's so much easier to be mean and bad and lie and take than it is to try to be good and to try to feel for other people. It takes effort, and it's something that is endemically human, and we all really have to try hard to do.
Chris Ware, his new graphic novel is called Rusty Brown. Chris, that wasn't so bad, was it? Was that okay?
Thank you very, very much for having me. It's a real honor.
Sure.
I really appreciate it. So.
And hopefully that was not too painful?
Not at all, no.
Fantastic. Well, we will keep our painless conversations going with our next guest, Melanie Gilman. They'll talk about a new Western story starring queer characters called Stage Dreams. Stay close.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Rothy's. Rothy's are the stylish, comfortable, and sustainable flats seamlessly crafted from repurposed plastic bottles. Available in a range of colors, patterns, and styles, like flats, loafers, and sneakers. Fully machine washable and no break-in period. Discover why BuzzFeed called them their forever shoes. Rothy's always offers free shipping and free returns and exchanges. Go to rothys.com/1A to find out more.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
How do you take a single idea and turn it into a billion-dollar empire, even against all odds? I'm Guy Raz, and every Monday on NPR's How I Built This, I speak with the innovators behind the world's most influential brands. Listen and subscribe right now.
This is 1A. Picture the Wild West. What do you see? Horses and buggies, tumbleweeds,
strapping cowboys with lasso in hand.
Well, how about a queer bandit and a trans runaway? LGBTQ stories are put out of the history of the Old West, but they were rarely recorded and rarely told. Melanie Gilman is looking to change that. They're the cartoonist behind the new graphic novel Stage Dreams, and they join us from NPR in New York. Melanie, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Before we dive into the conversation, some folks may have noticed that I reference you as they. That's your preferred pronoun, right?
Yes, that is the grammatically correct pronoun for me. It's dictionary official and everything now.
It is indeed. That last revision from Merriam-Webster that last week added a definition for the word they as a personal pronoun for people who are gender non-binary. So, just wanted to make that clear before we went deeper into our conversation. Tell us a little more about Stage Dreams. What's it about?
So Stage Dreams is a YA Western romance. It's set in 1861 New Mexico.
I'm sorry, YA, young adult?
Yes, young adult. So good for readers, probably like age 12 and up. I figure, you know, if they're old enough that the fact that it's a kissing book isn't going to bother them, then they're probably good to go with this book. So 1861 New Mexico, there was actually a campaign of the Civil War that went through New Mexico, and we don't actually hear a lot of that history. You know, I never learned any of it growing up, and found out about it as an adult and was like, hey, there's actually kind of an interesting story going on here where we have, you know, Confederate troops that are trying to trample through the deserts in New Mexico en route to California that they really wanted to reach. And they ended up getting turned back at around Santa Fe by, you know, like a battalion of Union troops who are like fighting out of a mud fort in Fort Union. And I got really interested in this history. And I also, at the same time, you know, I'm a queer person. I'm a non-binary person. I'm very interested in aspects of queer history and wanted to see if I could bring these two things together, these two bits of kind of untold history, this narrative of the Civil War and narratives about the lives of queer and trans people in the American West in the 1800s.
How did you get into graphic novels and cartoon art? Were you always into it, or is it something you kind of discovered over time?
You know, I really didn't discover comics until about undergrad. You know, when I was growing up, and this would have been in the, like, 90s, early 2000s, you know, if you're, like, a young queer femme person, a lot of comics aren't really catering to you at that stage in history. You know, there was superhero comics, there were, you know, kind of gritty, dark adult comics, and all of them are kind of these, like very masculine power fantasies, and that was not a thing that really appealed to my interests at the time, so I kind of wrote off comics as a medium at that age. It really wasn't until I got to college and I discovered web comics, that I really got invested in the comics medium. And the thing about webcomics is when you're posting a comic online, all of those publishing gatekeepers that have traditionally kept women and queer people and trans people and people of color out of the publishing industry, you know, those barriers aren't there online. You know, anyone can post a comic online. So being able to find webcomics was the first time that I was able to find stories that were being written by and for people like me and people like the other people in my community. So I finally found stories that I was able to actually respond to. And that was the thing that really, you know, kind of opened the floodgates on comics for me, made me get really excited about the possibilities of the medium and the storytelling potential and the way that, you know, non-traditional publishing venues like the internet can be used as a way to get around those gatekeepers that are keeping marginalized voices from being able to talk about their own experiences.
Interesting you mentioned webcomics because one of our listeners mentioned that as well. Here's what Christopher left in our inbox.
Hello, this is Christopher Galbraith from San Antonio, Texas. What got me into graphic novels was actually back during the manga craze, back in the late 90s and early 2000s, and then later the advent of webcomics, and that got me even further, being able to explore a wider range of genres than even what DC and Marvel provided.
Chris, thanks for sharing that with us. And you, Melanie, created a webcomic called As the Crow Flies, still online. It's about a queer 13-year-old girl of color who's at an all-white Christian youth backpacking camp. Now, I read a little bit of it, and it kind of gave me a flashback. I was like, oh my God, I went to this camp, and I was that girl, but I was a boy. So it was kind of interesting to see that experience reflected. What inspired, once you started getting into this kind of artwork, what was it about it that kept you going in it? What did you get out of it?
Well, for comics in general, one of the beautiful things about the comics medium, and it's something that is almost impossible to replicate in any other medium, is that they're very auteur-focused in a way. You know, oftentimes there, especially with webcomics, there will be one person who is both writing and drawing the artwork for this piece. And when you're thinking about especially queer representation and trans representation in comics, comics is one of the few mediums where I really think that it's as close as you can get to looking visually through another person's eyes. You're seeing a visual depiction of how another person views the world in a visual, literal sense. And that's something that's kind of only possible with a medium like comics, which is so personal and so unique to each individual creator that's leaving their mark on the page. And for queer and trans narratives specifically, that visual element is so important because so many visual depictions of queer and trans people at the moment are still being primarily created and documented by people who are outside the community looking in. So when you're looking at comics, when you're looking at especially, you know, web comics, self-published comics, comics by queer and trans people who are, you know, evading those gatekeepers and putting their own work out online, what you're seeing is you're seeing trans people depicted through the lens of trans people's gaze, and queer people depicted through the lens of queer people's eyes. And that's something that is so wonderful and so unique to the comics medium. And that was the thing that really got me invested in, you know, every book that I do, the thing that I always want to be putting out there are positive depictions of queer and trans youth, especially because, you know, that was a thing that I grew up completely without. You know, when I would walk into a library or a bookstore as a young person, it was impossible for me to find books that had any sort of realistic and empathetic depictions of people like me, people who were going through things that I was going through. So I'm lucky enough to be in a position now as an adult where I can actually, you know, be on the other side of that equation and put the books out there that I wish I had had as a kid and that I know are going to be valuable for kids today who still need these depictions.
You did a lot of research about LGBT life in the Old West. Can you talk about maybe if there was one thing in particular that you learned that really informed your work and what you had to do to kind of dig that information out? I assume it wasn't terribly easy to unearth.
No, definitely not. So researching queer and trans history, you know, going back further than like the 1900s can be really complicated. One of the complicated things was terminology, because our language around queer and trans people has changed so much in the past, you know, 50, 100 years. So I can't necessarily, you know, stroll into my local library and go into their archives of old newspapers and be like, give me all the newspaper clippings from 1800s that have the word transgender in it, because that word didn't exist back then, which isn't the same thing as saying that trans people didn't exist back then, because there were stories about trans people that were being documented in local newspapers. They just didn't use the same language for them. One of the things that I found when I was doing this research, especially for trans Americans in the Old West, there would be stories about them, but oftentimes they would be little, like very, very short, sometimes just a sentence or two newspaper clippings. And they would definitely be written by, you know, cis journalists who are trying to scandalize their audiences in a way. And oftentimes these newspaper clippings would be something to the effect of, and I apologize for the language here, like local man discovered to be a woman after death. So it'd be things like a coroner would be dressing a body after it has died and then would find out that this person was, you know, quote unquote, actually a different gender. And they would write the newspapers about it, and there would be a paragraph that showed up in a local newspaper. And the interesting thing is, oftentimes, those are the only records that we have of these people, because if you were a trans person who was living in a time period where it was not safe to be openly trans for most people, you oftentimes tried pretty deliberately to live kind of a stealthy life. You were trying to avoid public scrutiny. You did not want to be publicly outed. So oftentimes, it's only these people who were outed against their will after their death by coroners, by medical professionals, by law enforcement. Those are the stories that we finally get little glimpses of these people's lives from. And the records are so few and far between. Oftentimes it's just a sentence, just two sentences, just the barest amount of information. But one of the nice things that happened with me working on Stage Dreams, since this is a historical fiction comic rather than a historical nonfiction comic,
right,
when you're working with records which are so few and far between and so light on detail and information, that would make it really hard to write, for instance, a straight-up biography of a single person.
Right, right.
But you can take a lot of those different records and kind of piece them together into a sort of a patchwork quilt and draw on all of the little bits of information about lots of different people's lives and kind of weave them together into a single narrative. And that's what I ended up doing for Stage Dreams.
It has to feel a little bit like a big responsibility, Melanie, in terms of the gap that you are filling. We hear from a lot of our listeners about why they love graphic novels. And actually, let me share one more voicemail from a listener about their love of graphic novels. Here's what Gina left in our inbox.
This is Gina calling from Fort Collins, Colorado, regarding graphic novels. I think they're great. I love them for the popularity, especially for my children. I have two that would otherwise complain about reading. And I have another child who is loving practicing how to draw as if she's a graphic artist herself and creates her own comic book and short graphic novels.
Yeah, Gina, thank you for sharing your story with us. And you're right. I know a number of educators who have used graphic novels as a way in to fire kids' imaginations about reading, or librarians who will tell kids, you can check out a graphic novel, but first you have to check out a conventional prose book, and then you can have the graphic novel as well. By the way, we have shared some images from Stage Dreams on our Twitter feed, which is @1A. But Melanie, I imagine it can feel like a big responsibility with some of the books that you've done and the webcomics. I mean, your artwork might be the very first time that a young person really has a chance to think about what it means to be queer, or the first time that a queer kid might see themselves reflected back.
Yes, yes, there's a big responsibility. A lot of people term this rep sweats, like representation sweats, where there's a big burden on your shoulders when you're a marginalized artist working from, you know, an underrepresented perspective, because you know, when there's so few books out there that are representing your own experiences and the experiences of your community, there's a big responsibility to make sure that you're getting it right, that you're not accidentally stepping on anyone's toes or getting things wrong. There's a lot of pressure, but luckily, I do see, especially in comics, that there has been kind of a sea change happening where, you know, I certainly am not the only queer or trans cartoonist who is publishing work right now. There's actually like this whole generation up and coming of cartoonists is actually full of queer and trans writers and artists. So it's actually really wonderful to, you know, not quite feel like so much of the burden is on your shoulders alone, because it's actually a community of people who's coming up in this generation, and we're taking advantage of changes in public mindset, in the publishing industry, in demand from young readers that are all kind of changing the conversation around queer and trans people and making more opportunities along the way. So it's been really wonderful, you know, not just being, you know, having the task of putting these books out and obviously feeling like you got to do a good job with them, and you got to be very careful and conscientious about the way that you are writing these stories, but also recognize that you're part of a community and that that there's actually kind of a wealth of stories that are being put out right now, especially if you go online. So it's been really wonderful being a part of this queer comics community that's coming up right now.
Yeah, Kate is also turned on to this kind of work. She referenced that in her tweet to us. Kate writes, "The first graphic novel I fell in love with was Love and Rockets by the Hernandez brothers. They're bi and lesbian aging punk rockers were characters I could really relate to. And watching these characters age over the years has been amazing." I think some people might have a similar reaction to your new graphic novel called Stage Dreams. It is written by Melanie Gilman. Melanie, congratulations on your new book, and thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Today's conversation was produced by Avery Kleinman and edited by Miranda Fulmore. You can learn more about our team online at the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.